on to the second case this morning, which is Nabisco Inc. versus AUL and a number of others. There are a lot of attorneys who are scheduled to say something, so I hope you all have your times worked out, and I'll expect you to adhere to them. I'm not going to try to interrupt, so watch your light and your time. First up, I guess, is Mr. Kelly for Nabisco.
May it please the court, Gerard Kelly from Nabisco.
Can we get to taste the cookies?
Your Honor, I got...
This is a first.
This is, it's a first for me, Your Honor. I don't usually prepare for oral argument by going to Dominic's, but these just were purchased yesterday at Dominic's. They didn't come from the warehouse, so we'll distribute them evenly afterwards. This case, as the court is aware, involves a warehouse that was constructed by the various appellees, or the appellees either supervise the construction in the case of Catellus, or in with respect to Krasinski and all the subcontractors and suppliers that actually constructed the warehouse. The warehouse was constructed in a manner such that the floor was finished with two compounds that had aromatic hydrocarbons, principally trimethylbenzene, in them. The new warehouse, in September of 1998, Nabisco moved its food products, including Oreos and Triscuits and other, very familiar product, into the warehouse. And the warehouse, unfortunately, was at that very moment suffused with trimethylbenzene. Although it was not apparent. At the time, for whatever reason, nobody could notice it. There was some in discovery discussion with respect to certain people who identified off odors in the warehouse, although that was not something that was known at the time that the pleadings were originally filed.
Did it form any part of the decision in the case?
No, it did not, Your Honor. I just mention that because in several of the respondents have pointed to the fact that there was no allegation that there was a smell there. If that were a turning point in this case, we would argue that we could very easily amend to add that allegation. The magistrate judge to whom this matter was referred, in our opinion, committed error, and that error was very simple. Magistrate Judge Ashman looked at the allegations that were before him and the contending allegations as to how this damage to our product took place, and he, after noting the difference, our view that these products were damaged the moment that an Oreo cookie package wrapped in polypropylene wrapping that Your Honor see before us here today entered that warehouse, it is exposed to the trimethylbenzene and becomes tainted and unsalable, versus the characterization that appears in the brief filed by Catellus and most of the construction defendants, where I think the phrase they use is the slow osmosis of hydrocarbons through the buildings and into the product. Those are the two contending characterizations, and I think we have two basic points. One is that they are exactly that. They are contending characterizations. The briefs read like closing arguments after a jury trial. They don't read like briefs on a motion to dismiss, where the facts are not the issue, but the law is the issue.
What facts would go beyond it? Do you have some sort of expert testimony or scientific testimony that said that after an Oreo package in polypropylene or whatever it is in this environment for 10 seconds or 2 days or something, that then it's contaminated?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There is expert testimony and testing that was done that shows that there is a varying levels of the contamination, but there's that the packages are subject to contamination the moment they get in there. And furthermore, you know, from our perspective, Your Honor, you know, one molecule of the contamination is too much. Think of it. If we put those Oreos into the stream of commerce, and at the Dominick's when I went there yesterday, there was no sign that said, you know, let's think if there had been a sign that says, well, these Oreos were only briefly exposed to a warehouse that had trimethylbenzene in its atmosphere. How many packages would be saleable? Could Nabisco have sold those products? The answer is clearly no. Those products were damaged. And they were damaged the moment that they entered the warehouse. And if need be, we could add that allegation if necessary. And we were not given that opportunity.
Well, you had four opportunities to amend your complaint.
Your Honor, but we never had the sufficiency of our initial allegations tested. And as Your Honor is aware from seeing the record, the motion to dismiss was filed in April of 1999. The decision did not come down until May 31, 2000, during which time all the discovery proceeded. And the magistrate judge is overworked, and when we appeared before him on all sorts of other matters, he explained to us that, you know, your brief keeps getting closer and closer to the top, and I just deal with these things in the order that they get there. But we never had our allegations tested. There was never the resolution, and none of the amendments related in any way to these allegations. We were faced with a situation where if we had made that amendment, we would have gone back to the bottom of the pile, because I don't think anyone would reasonably suggest that if we made what in the Catellus brief they argue would be a simple amendment, add the word sudden into your pleadings, if that actual word were added, as opposed to the facts which we think clearly show, if reasonably construed in our favor, that it was a sudden damage.
What are those facts that you allege that you believe show that it's sudden?
What we allege, Your Honor, is that, you know, that the testing ultimately revealed that all of the polypropylene product in the package in the warehouse was affected or potentially affected, and all of it had to be destroyed. Your Honor, we shut down the warehouse immediately when the complaints came in, and we traced the source of the complaints to the warehouse, and the only product that was ever
released... Well, the issue is whether there can be a reasonable inference drawn that it was sudden.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor, and that inference has to be drawn in our favor as the non-movement. And in this situation where the magistrate judge clearly understood that to be our position, the appropriate action on his part, if he felt that there needed to be additional allegations, would simply have been to say, amend. There has been no prejudice to the other parties. We have proceeded with discovery. There are other issues. The discovery is practically complete. There are other issues that were addressed with respect to the contract and the warranty claims that come in through AUL, and that's the subject of the other complaint. But there, you know, in this situation, to suggest that the amendment now to add a few more phrases on an issue that was well known to all the parties. These briefs were filed. The discovery focuses on the question of sudden. How quickly did it happen? Where did it happen? All of those issues are things that we addressed in discovery. There is simply no prejudice to saying, okay, well, let's give Nabisco a chance to amend now that we have, the district court has finally had an opportunity to rule on the sufficiency of the allegation. As we say, there was only one ruling, no opportunity to amend.
Now, most of the fighting here has been on whether or not the damage was caused suddenly. And can you speak to the Mormon case and the Chicago flood case and that Elizabeth Bank case? Because, you know, it sort of refocus the issue here, because if Mormon doesn't apply here, then I think that bodes well for you.
Well, I think that...
What do you think it does?
I think that we fall clearly within the exception to the Mormon doctrine for a damage to other property. And this is clearly other property. The product, the defective product, is the warehouse. The other property is our Oreos and Triscuits, et cetera.
So you don't even need to meet that suddenness test.
No, I think that is suggested, but it's really the exception to the Mormon doctrine that I think applies. The sudden or dangerous exception to the Mormon doctrine is what affects the other property issue, Your Honor. And I think that we clearly meet that, and particularly under the Chicago flood case. Because in the Chicago flood case, what the Illinois Supreme Court says is perishable inventory that was damaged when the electricity went out in that flood is subject to a tort claim. And that is, you know, I'm virtually on all fours with the situation that we have here. And
I know
I think
what the tortious event was in that case, but suddenly, you know, you've got this big flood and suddenly all electricity is off. What's the sudden or calamitous event here?
The sudden or calamitous event is the exposure of our product to trimethylbenzene, and it's the exposure that the trimethylbenzene that's in the air in the warehouse.
So it's just a matter of putting this stuff in the warehouse.
That's right. As soon as our trucks were offloaded into that warehouse, these products were exposed to trimethylbenzene. And at that point, we were rendered unsalable. They were damaged. The contamination began. And there's no acceptable level of contamination. And so with that, I guess I would like to just sum up by making an observation with respect to two analogies. One is the splashing with gasoline analogy, which I think has been misconstrued. This would have been no different. Our product was splashed with trimethylbenzene when it went into the air in that warehouse. If they had had a mister with gasoline operating in that warehouse, that would have had the same impact. It would have been just as unsalable, no difference. Secondly, with respect to the refrigerator analogy that was used by Justice Simon in his concurrence in Mormon and was also relied upon by Catellus and the other appellees, in their brief, I think that analogy, number one, is overruled by the very specific facts of the Chicago flood case, and number two is not accurate with respect to our case. That analogy where he says, you know, if the refrigerator doesn't function and the food spoils, he said there was no claim. Clearly not under the Chicago flood. And also in our case, the better analogy would be the refrigerator malfunctions and spews Freon onto the content of the refrigerator, not that it doesn't function. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Lieber?
May it please the court. My name is Howard Lieber. I represent two parties in before the court here, Central American Warehouse Company and American United Logistics.
I'm going to ask one preliminary. Would you tell me what their relationship is?
My understanding is they are affiliated companies.
What does that mean?
They are separate corporations. The president of each company is Froilan Concepcion. They have separate books, separate records. Nabisco, in the fourth amended complaint, has sought to pierce the corporate veil and to basically say that they are both, in essence, one entity controlled by Mr. Concepcion.
I guess I just want to have clear in my mind why Central enters into the lease with Catellus and AUL enters into the warehouse agreement with Nabisco. I just didn't see any written connection.
If I can just quickly give you a little background on that point. AUL has a contract and had a contract at that time with Nabisco, a warehouse agreement. Under the terms of that agreement, the relationship between AUL and Nabisco was defined as one of bailment. Nabisco was a customer of AUL. It was AUL's only customer. Nabisco came to AUL and said, "We need more space for storage. Can you get us a larger facility?" Mr. Concepcion is the president of AUL. Spoke to his real estate broker. They put him in contact with Catellus. There was a meeting. There was a discussion. As you may know from the record, there was an initial draft lease that had AUL's name on it as the tenant. during the course of the negotiations, as I understand them from the deposition testimony, Catellus was seeking to sell the building to Invesco. And apparently there were some discussions about the duration of the length of time that AUL had been in operation. And apparently there was a greater comfort level with Central American because it was in operation for a longer period of time than AUL. Mr. Concepcion is the president of both companies. As I understand it, at virtually the last minute, the decision was made to make the Invesco people happy and Catellus happy. It would simply be under the name of Central American, the lease, and that is why in paragraph 15 of the lease itself, AUL's name was added so that the language is in there that the tenant, Central American, will conduct its operations under its own name and the names of its affiliates, and then there's a parenthesis, e.g., AUL. So in essence, this goes to the issue of, is AUL really a direct beneficiary of the lease? And without question, the lease would not have been entered into but for AUL's need for space to accommodate Nabisco's product. The district court, if I can switch gears for a moment here and go to the issues regarding Central American, because I do have issues for Central and AUL. With respect to Central American, the district court dismissed those counts of the first amended third-party complaint that were filed in this case that related to the breach of contract claims. The district court dismissed those breach of contract claims through the warranties by assignment on the grounds of arbitration. In essence, the lease has an arbitration provision in it between Catellus and Central American. What the district court basically did was to say all issues that are arising in any shape or form with any party related to the lease must be arbitrated. The problem in this case is that the construction defendants in the subcontract and in the general contract between Krasinski and Catellus, the construction contract they signed, none of them contain arbitration requirements. And in a long line of cases, in this jurisdiction and in other jurisdictions, it has consistently been held that a party cannot be compelled to arbitrate or compel arbitration when they have not agreed to do that. None of the construction defendants agreed to arbitrate. Central and Catellus have no right to force those parties and cannot force those parties to arbitrate. Additionally, Central never agreed to arbitrate issues relating to the warranties given by third parties. The language of the lease simply says that Catellus and Central American will arbitrate issues related to the lease.
Of course, we wouldn't get to that issue if the if the AUL or Central have no standing to sue under the lease.
Well, Central American is a signatory to the lease. So Central American gets the, as we argue, the right to sue under the lease by way of assignment. Now, as you know from the record, Section 15 of a work letter that's attached to the lease says that Central will rely on the warranties and guarantees given by the construction parties involved in the construction of the building.
It's a pretty vague assignment, though, isn't it?
Well, under Illinois law, going back to at least 1975 in a case by the name of Riven Die Molding versus Stuart Warner, it's consistently been held that it is the intent of the parties that controls what language is necessary for purposes of an assignment. There is no specific language that is required under applicable law to constitute an assignment. So in that case, in Riven, and at least four other cases that we've cited that follow that, the court has said you have to look at the intent of the parties, including the surrounding circumstances. Now, in this case, Mr. Antonucci of Catellus, the vice president, who signed the lease on behalf of Catellus, has been deposed. And there is no dispute that Mr. Antonucci has testified about a couple things. Number one, it was a triple net lease, which provides that it is the tenant that has the responsibility for the repair and maintenance of the building. And Mr. Antonucci specifically said that it was the intent of that language in the lease that the tenant would have the benefit of the warranty.
Well, first we'd have to say that's ambiguous, that it's not clear on its face, whatever it is, paragraph 15 or whatever, and in that event would then be able to go to extrinsic evidence.
I think that that is, if it was ambiguous, you're right. But
I assume it's saying you don't think it is ambiguous, right?
I frankly do not think it is ambiguous. I think that based on the testimony there, It is.
Well,
it
what
is,
do you mean based on the testimony?
It's based on the language of the document.
Okay.
But in addition to that, in the Riven case, they considered deposition testimony. And in another case by the name of Clem versus Grecian Chalet, they also considered deposition testimony in connection with the question of was something actually an assignment. Because the Illinois appellate courts have consistently said the surrounding circumstances have to be analyzed in addition to simply the language of the document. Now, based on that, the deposition testimony would be admissible and subject to consideration. And I think there's another point that we shouldn't forget here. This is an appeal from a Rule 12b6 ruling. And as I understand the prior decisions of this court and other courts, in that situation, the question arises, is there any set of facts or circumstances that could support the allegations of the complaint? I think it's clear here that either the language of Section 15 for the purposes of assignment is either clear or subject to the interpretation by way of deposition testimony under the Riven case and the cases that follow that, or if you want to take the position of the construction defendants that they have a different interpretation of that language, then it is subject to more than one interpretation, and there is an ambiguity, and in either case, outside testimony, such as that of Mr. Antonucci, is subject to consideration. There is a set of facts upon which an assignment can clearly be established to exist here. Now, the second aspect of what I wanted to argue before you today relates to AUL. And principally, as you know, the district court denied AUL leave to file a first amended third-party complaint. That complaint sought to add bailment counts to the existing complaint already against all of the defendants. Now, there were three orders set forth by the district court, a February 8th order, a March 9th order, and a March 26th order. In the February 8th order, the district court specifically said that AUL had entered into a contract with Nabisco for the storage of Nabisco's goods. In the March 8th order, the district court said AUL is neither a bailee nor a bailor and has no rights or remedies under the law of bailment. Nabisco filed a motion for reconsideration because that impacted Nabisco's bailment count against AUL. In the March 26th order, the district court said AUL can be sued as a bailee, but AUL has no rights or remedies under the law of bailment. There is no case law that the district court used to support that. There was no rationale offered as to how AUL could have the obligations of a bailee, but not have any benefits or rights under the law of bailment.
Well, suppose under the warehouse agreement it is a bailee. What would its amended complaint say as far as its right to sue somebody?
The amended complaint, which we had offered to the district court, basically says that AUL has the right, because of a possessory interest in the goods, to sue the construction defendants for the damage that they have caused to Nabisco's product.
That goes back to my original question. AUL's connection to Central, who actually signed the lease, and then you get back to this assignment issue. You have to trace it all back through these written agreements, I think.
Well, I disagree.
Because otherwise, I'm looking for a contract connection. I think you're going to say it's a sudden occurrence and a tort.
Actually, the way I view this, there's a distinction. The Central American aspect is related to the contract. The Central American aspect, the rights flow through the lease for purposes of assignment. AUL's portion of it is independent of that, because AUL as a bailee has direct rights that come from a bailment to sue third parties. In essence, under the law of bailment, the cases provide that AUL as a bailee has what they call a possessory interest in the goods that have been bailed to it. And because of that possessory interest, AUL has the right to pursue parties who damage or interfere with the bailment. And in that situation, AUL has a cause of action.
Against the construction companies?
Yes. Against anyone who...
Based on some breach of warranty or on some tort?
I believe it would be based on a tort. And if I can explain, my view, AUL's position with respect to the In Re Chicago flood case is different than that of Nabisco. We are not arguing that it is a sudden event. Under the In Re Chicago flood case with respect to the perishable inventory, the Illinois Supreme Court in that case said that the parties that were suing for the damage to the perishable inventory were not suing for a disappointed commercial expectation because they were not suing for the loss of electrical service in terms of restoring it or repairing it. They were suing for damage to goods, which was above and beyond their commercial expectation. What AUL is suing for here is the same type of thing. It is on all fours because AUL had a commercial expectation in the continuous occupancy of the warehouse space. But AUL is not suing for the repair or replacement of the warehouse space or for lost profits. It is simply suing as a bailee for damage to the goods that have been put in the warehouse and that have been damaged by the construction defendant's use of chemicals that were not called for under the plans and which contained chemicals that got into the product. So there's a distinction between Nabisco's argument about suddenness and our argument, because we are saying AUL's claim is not included within the economic loss doctrine. So you don't even get to the question of the three exceptions to the economic loss doctrine. Nabisco is saying that their claim falls within one of the exceptions. Our position is, because of the nature of AUL's relationship and the fact that AUL is not suing for a disappointed commercial expectation, it is not a matter of there being the economic loss doctrine applicable.
So even though this is Nabisco's product and it's measured in their, what they call a $28 million loss, you say your claim is different than Nabisco.
The theory is different.
Theory, well.
The damages
the
would be
damage,
the same.
But you as a bailee have a different cause of action, I guess.
To the extent that Nabisco would be seeking to set forth a negligence cause of action, and to the extent that we are setting forth a cause of action which is for a tort through bailment, the causes of action may be similar, but the theories with respect to the economic loss doctrine are different. Because the case law, some of the cases that we cited, for example, from Massachusetts, there's a case by the name of Priority Finishing, which involved a company that was in the business of dyeing fabrics. This is a case very similar to the In Re Chicago flood and our case with Nabisco. In the Priority Finishing case, it was a situation where a bailee, the company had taken people's fabrics, they were in dye vats, and a construction company on one occasion had cut electric service to that bailee, and on another case had cut water service to that bailee. In both cases, the bailed goods were damaged. And what the appellate court in Massachusetts said was that the economic loss doctrine did not bar the claim being made by the bailee because of the fact that the bailee had a pecuniary interest in the bailed goods. The same situation prevails here. The district court erred in this case by finding that the economic loss doctrine was applicable to AUL and in fact never really conducted any analysis of the applicability of the economic loss doctrine to AUL, but simply said, I've already ruled on that with respect to Nabisco, it's a closed issue. If there are no other questions, I see my time is up, and I would just suggest that there is a basis to reverse the district court and reinstate the claims. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay, now you're Mr. Nowacki?
Yeah.
Okay. How much time do you have?
18 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay. You keep track of it.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, and good morning. I am Jim Nowacki, and I'm representing Catellus Development Corporation, but I'm going to make three arguments jointly on behalf of not only Catellus, but Krasinski, Artlow, Randonicio, Hydrite, Specco, and Blocker. And then I've got two issues specifically for Catellus. Let's deal with the first issue raised by Nabisco and their argument, which deals with the judge's determination to dismiss this case on the economic loss doctrine bar on the tort claim here. I went through all those lists of people, these clients here of the various attorneys who are parties to this case and appellees, because the thing that's remarkable here is each one of them has a contractual relationship down the line. Catellus with Krasinski as the general contractor, and then two subcontractors, two suppliers of the products at issue that were placed into the floor during the construction process, and Blocker involved with the soil for the under foundation of this warehouse. Nabisco has no contract with any of those parties. AUL has no contract with any of those parties. Yet despite the carefully bargained provisions voted with dollars on the allocations of risk in those contracts, Nabisco and AUL seek to bypass the law of contract and sue those they don't have a contract with under the law of tort. I want to answer the question, why would they want to do that? It's because a sophisticated big company like Nabisco executed and negotiated a relatively poor contract with AUL. They stored $32 million worth of product in the warehouse, and that's in the pleadings. And their contract with AUL called for only $1 million of occurrence coverage for commercial liability and $3.5 million for liability for the warehouse operations of AUL. So they want to bypass the contractual framework to get at those people they didn't contract with because they don't like the bargain they struck. Yet in the bargain they struck, precisely in that contract, the issue of the protection of Nabisco's product against odor is covered. This case is not any different, Your Honors, from a warehouse where they bargained to have it at a certain temperature. And for one reason or another, down the line, someone caused the facility to run at a higher temperature. And as soon as they brought their product into that warehouse, the Chips Ahoy, with its little chocolate bits in it, melted and pooled at the bottom of the bag. There's no question, I don't think, in any law that that kind of occurrence would not be subject to suing people not in the contracting framework in tort. It's not a tort issue. It's a disappointed economic expectation, commercial expectation. What Nabisco wants to sue the people it didn't contract with for is its cost for the goods it couldn't sell, for the profit it lost, and other costs for the next 2 years that occurred in testing and so forth, all of which are economic losses subject to the Mormon doctrine. And this is a case where suddenness isn't really even an exception it can grab onto, although it would like to try somehow to figure a way that it can sue in tort and avoid the contract it bargained. What it seizes upon is an argument that when other properties involved and there's a sudden, calamitous, or dangerous event, that the courts have made an exception and allowed people to bypass their contractual arrangements and sue in tort. So it wants to claim that this was sudden. In my example of the hot building, does it make a difference how quickly the chocolate melted? In this case, is the question this court's going to address on whether tort or contract applies going to be parsing what the time period is for a molecule to come out of the floor joints that had been constructed some months before, migrate through the air, which is precisely what Nabisco alleges, make its way through the poly packaging, but not through the metal packaging? This warehouse was perfectly suitable for Nabisco's product with metal packaging, and it says that. And then the amount of molecules to reach that point where someone could taste it or smell it in the product, have an odor, the cookies or crackers. That kind of analysis shouldn't be the one on which hinges whether this is a contract or tort action. They can't change the story that has been set out here that they contracted for a warehouse with certain characteristics.
The characteristics with respect to odor were included in that contract, and certain aspects of that warehouse weren't what they wanted, and some of their product could not be sold. That's what this case is about.
How do you distinguish the Chicago flood case?
Chicago flood case is a calamitous event. I mean, we're all here when that happened. And the court there denies recovery of every other tort claimant other than those who showed they had a quick loss of their perishable property. And you heard Mr. Lieber talk about that. First, we don't have perishable property here. And we don't have that kind of a calamitous event here. We have the same thing as if someone didn't get the telephone service they bargained for, or get the electricity they bargained for, or didn't get the heat they bargained for. Here they didn't get the environment they bargained for in the warehouse. Let's look also at how would they...
Well, would someone expect that sort of, not just odor, but some chemical process to invade the packaging and therefore destroy the product? You think that's covered by the contract just like heat is?
It is. They specifically bargained their contract for how this product was to be handled with respect to the subject of odor. And they had a set of regulations that were identified with respect to that. That's what they bargained for. The problem is they don't like the fact they can't recover enough because of the insurance issue. At least that's my argument as to why we're here. One thing I want to really stress, they actually plead and go out of their way to do so, that this whole event posed absolutely no danger to human health. We're not talking about perishable food someone could consume.
They're not talking about danger since that's dangerous. It's not conjunctive, right?
That's right, Your Honor. That's also why we took the position that this is one of those cases where the suddenness really isn't the issue. Suddenness doesn't create an exception here because courts aren't going to be involved in figuring out, now how fast would a molecule go to get into a piece of cookie so that it rises to the level of smelling or tasting with enough of that flavor of hydrocarbon that it's not merchantable. It's the law of merchant that should govern this. It's the law of contract.
Certainly wouldn't do that on a motion to dismiss.
On a motion to dismiss...
But didn't Judge Bucklow do just that?
She took the facts as pleaded. And what we're saying is, first of all, even if they had said that molecule had moved fast, which they claimed here today but didn't plead, it wouldn't make it any different. Well, that doesn't make it a tort because they move quickly.
She argues, she states, after saying that Nabisco says it was suddenly contaminated, then she goes on to say, defendants respond that the damage to Nabisco's food product occurred gradually over a period of time, which brings Nabisco's claims clearly within the Mormon doctrine. This court agrees. So she made a finding on a motion to dismiss that was gradual over a period of time, did she not?
Well, what she's saying there, Your Honor, I believe, is the reality of this story, which is you have an odor in the floor during construction in the summer. They bring product in, and it was stated here, no one smelled anything in the warehouse when that product was brought in. Over a period of months, these products were stored, moved in and out, and ultimately there were consumer complaints about some odor. They finally traced it back to this warehouse, and they decided there was a potential for the warehouse to be fully contaminated as to the poly packaging, not the metal, and so the conclusion was that they would remove it. But they allege that there was a small amount of aromatic hydrocarbon. They allege that it migrated through the air into the product. And we don't need to put aside logic. If you walked in and put the cookie in there and then took it out, that's different from a long period of time, and that's what she's reflecting, is the logic of the situation.
Well, how do we know that, though? From logic?
The logic of a natural conclusion which may be drawn from the pleadings, given these pleadings of migrating through the air.
Whether Nabisco could prove there has been no set of facts which been entitled to relief. I mean, that's a pretty high standard to go out on a motion to dismiss, isn't it?
I agree with that, Your Honor. And under these pleadings, the motion to dismiss was correct because the issue of how fast those hydrocarbons got there is not really the issue of suddenness. We're talking here, just as I gave the example at the beginning, of someone overheating the building Whether that melted chocolate occurred quickly or slowly really isn't an issue on determining that the law of contract applies, not allowing someone to run an end run on that law and sue people with whom they don't have a contract who bargained their own protections with respect to the contracting arrangement.
So your argument is it's not a question of fact, it's a question of law.
Absolutely, Your Honor, on these pleadings. That is correct. And if I may say, with respect to the issue of repleting, may I address that for a moment? We filed our motions, and there was hearing on those motions, and the briefing, all the motions were filed in March of 1999. The decision of the court was in June of 2000. Before that decision was rendered, but after all these arguments you've heard had been made, Nabisco twice amended its complaint. It did not change its story. The story of the migration through the air, the fact that packaging near the joints in the floor was more affected, the fact that the metal packaging was unaffected, the fact there was no injury here or health issue involved, and the fact that they were seeking basically economic damages of cost to manufacture product that had distasteful flavor, those didn't change one bit during those two amendments. So we have a motion to dismiss granted after they had opportunity on notice to make those amendments, but that's just one basis. The second basis for her proper decision, and certainly not an abuse of discretion, not to allow further amendment, was that Nabisco never offered an amended complaint for the court to consider. One of the requirements is that if someone wants to amend, they need to give the court an opportunity to see whether the amendment they propose cures the defect or whether it's even futile to make such an amendment. Nabisco didn't do that. Third, I submit they couldn't do it because they told their story in elaborate detail, and they knew that the issue of how fast a hydrocarbon got to the point from a floor to a product inside a package that you could taste or smell it was not the kind of basis on which a court was going to decide whether we're talking contract or tort. That wasn't what the Mormon case and its progeny was about. Talking about an unreasonably dangerous product and a sudden and calamitous event here. We don't have any of that. The other reason the judge was correct is that there was an amendment to the complaint made. After we were dismissed, Nabisco amended its complaint against AUL and Central America. They did not change their story. The same detailed set of facts talking about this migration, which we've called this osmosis, that goes from floor through air through package and different levels of exposure by virtue of where the product is located and whether it's metal or poly packaging, all of that never changed one bit. So the judge did not abuse her discretion in failing to allow further amendments, which would have been first futile, and secondly, they'd had certainly the opportunity, and they hadn't given her a chance to see what they would try to say. If I may, I'd like to go to the third joint point. That has to do with this bailment issue. AUL has brought a claim against Catellus and the others I've mentioned, not Specco and Hydride and Blocker, on the issue of bailment. Bailment is the law by which someone entrusts a bailee with property which they are take custody of and care for by contract. Because of the bailee's obligation, the law allows the bailee to stand in the shoes of the bailor and sue third parties who damage the property. That's the special property interest of the law of bailment. There is no new cause of action created by allowing that standing. This court's decision in Valenti versus Qualix was a case where a bailor had given film to a processor who gave it to a laboratory, and the bailor, the people, the photographers, tried to bypass the first contract, the one they had, and sue the processor, the laboratory, with whom they did not have a contract, claiming as a bailor that they could do that. This court held the economic loss doctrine still applies to law of bailment. And certainly AUL, as a bailee, can't have any more rights than the bailor has. And no case is said otherwise in Illinois, that's for sure. In fact, in Ray Flood litigation, the court rejected the argument that the law of nuisance was somehow an exception that allowed people to get around the economic loss doctrine bar. The court said, no, we're not going to carve out those exceptions, or the laws of tort will swallow up the law of contract. And that's what's at issue here. We don't want that to happen because people bargain commercial relationships. But the bailment issue is really not what AUL claims, and the court below understood that. This is not the case of AUL standing in the shoes of Nabisco to sue us for the bailed goods. Nabisco's suing them for the bailed goods. They're not doing this on Nabisco's behalf. They're suing the defendants as third-party defendants in the nature of indemnification, and their recovery they seek is whatever Nabisco gets against them. Clearly, the law of Mormon and its progeny on economic loss applies just as much to a third-party action as it does to the primary action. So all the cases that were cited by AUL dealing with the law of bailment have nothing to do with this case. This is a third-party case by somebody who's a bailee being sued by the bailor who says, I need to get the third parties in here in case I'm going to have a judgment against me. That's what that's about. Let me deal, Your Honor, with just...
Run low. Hurry up.
Two more. One, third-party beneficiary. The contract, after everything that was said, the contract says there is to be nothing in the lease, our lease with Central American, nothing in the lease creates any third-party benefit here under. That language is clearly dispositive. And there's no, in the case of Sargent and Lundy versus State of Illinois, when that kind of language is there, that's the end. I have one more point, but I've run out of time, Your Honor.
Okay. Who's next? Mr. Fallon?
Good morning, Your Honors. Randall Talon, counsel for Brandon ECO. I will address two issues on behalf of the three construction defendants. First, very briefly on the third-party beneficiary issue, but only as it pertains to AUL's claim that it is somehow a third-party beneficiary of the underlying construction contracts. They made that allegation in their complaint. Was dismissed by the district court. They raised the issue on appeal and threw it in with their discussions on third-party beneficiary as to Catellus, but they made no argument in their appellate brief or in their reply brief in support of their position, and so we maintain that they've waived that issue on appeal. Now, this is understandable that they didn't raise anything because there's nothing they could raise. Because when you look at those construction contracts that were entered into several months before AUL or Central came on the scene, there is nothing in those contracts that in any way show an intent on the part of Krasinski, Brandon Ecio, or Artlow to create some direct benefit for AUL or for tenants in general. So based on our position of waiver and based on the law as stated in Federal Insurance and AlphaVote, which is clear as can be, we ask that those counts dismissing AUL's third-party beneficiary claim against the construction defendants be affirmed. I'd like to spend a little more time on behalf of the construction defendants as to the assignment issue. Central American has these breach of contract counts which were dismissed by the district court based on a claim that Catellus assigned whatever warranty rights it had to Central. Judge Buchlow dismissed all of those counts, and she made reference to these, the arbitration clause. Mr. Lieber points out that the construction defendants are not parties to any agreement wherein they agree to submit to arbitration, and that is true. The position of the construction defendants is that there has been, was raised in the lower court, raised in our briefs, another grounds, a substantive grounds for the dismissal of AUL's breach of, assignment of warranty counts, and that goes to the fact that there was no assignment of warranty by Catellus to Central. And the law on this point is clear that the Court of Appeals can affirm the district court's dismissal of counts on any grounds that appears fairly in the record, even if it was not the grounds that the trial court relied on. Now, as to the merits or demerits of Central American's assignment of warranty claim, they take a single sentence out of the section 15 of the work letter, and they say this sentence creates an assignment by Catellus, which under the law necessitates a complete relinquishment of Catellus' rights under whatever warranties it had, and then we're going to give it to this tenant, Central. That one sentence simply says that Central will rely, with regard to proper design and construction, on warranties, if any, that may extend to it, which may have been issued by any of the construction defendants. That's what Central relies on. When you, it doesn't say, that sentence doesn't say anything about assignment or relinquishment. Now, the case law is clear, especially the air safety case. There was an integration clause. The lease is clear on its face that it is not an assignment. When you have those two things, when you have a clear document and you have an integration clause, you don't go outside the instrument to determine, to bring an ambiguity into it. The reliance on Antonucci's testimony as to what he wouldn't have been surprised the parties may have intended to is vague and conclusory, and in direct violation of the Four Corners Rule, and Judge Buchlow was proper in on two occasions excluding that testimony. And therefore, we ask that these assignment counts be dismissed on their merits. Thank you.
And thanks. Mr. Shipley?
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is Robert Shipley, and I represent Artlow in this litigation. And on behalf of Artlow and Brandon Isil, I will address the express warranty claim of Central American. On this issue, the third-party complaint essentially pleads a breach of contract theory. The Court has previously, in its comments, recognized the contract connection with respect to the construction defendants, and counsel for Central has acknowledged in his remarks that this is essentially a contract case to those defendants. And the basic principles of contract law necessarily lead to the rejection of Central's argument on the express warranty. In seeking to enforce an express warranty, in the absence of an assignment which establishes the necessary requirements of privity, Central asserts an argument which is contrary to the Collins case, which does reflect Illinois law on this issue. Although below and in its brief, Central does cite to some of the basic legal principles in Collins correctly, its argument of that case, of its holding, is incorrect, or alternatively, they seek to improperly expand the reach of Collins. And I believe that the weakness of that position is demonstrated by the reliance on the parole testimony of Ted Antonucci, which has been previously addressed by counsel, and the work letter, paragraph 15 of the work letter, which merely identifies scope of warranties that might be relied upon as between Central and Catellus. The Collins case rejected the precise argument raised by Central by declining to extend an express warranty beyond its original holder in the absence of a formal assignment. This holding was consistent with the Sedgman case, which was discussed within Collins, which, although it dealt with the issue on an implied warranty, reached an identical.
You finish your sentence, whatever.
I'm done. Thank
you. Did it. Okay.
That was quick.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Enderlich?
May it please the Court, Kathy Enderlich, Counsel for Specco Industries, Inc., also speaking on behalf of Hydrite Chemical Company. We would join in the arguments made by Mr. Nowacki as to the District Court properly finding the economic loss Forman doctrine applied, and also on the issue of whether the District Court properly denied plaintiff leave to amend. Hydrite and Specco are the manufacturers of two products allegedly used on this floor. Specco's Cure and Seal was used in July after the cement was poured, and Hydrite's R-Solve was allegedly used in August to strip the floor. We believe there's another basis upon which the District Court can be affirmed, and that neither Specco nor Hydrite owed any duty to plaintiffs to provide them a warning. They were sued under a negligence theory in count three, alleging they had a duty to warn. Nabisco had no relationship whatsoever with these two manufacturing defendants. I would point out that although the case continued and various third-party actions were brought, nobody brought in these two manufacturers, the people who used the product, on a failure to warn. Plaintiff relies upon the case of Modelsky versus Navistar for its proposition that it adequately pled there was a duty to warn. But in Modelsky, they cited from the Supreme Court of Illinois, Woodill versus Park Davis, there must be a dangerous propensity of the product for a duty to warn to be owed. Plaintiff here conceded there was no health hazard associated with this product. We ask this court to find that these two manufacturers owed no duty to warn to plaintiffs. There was no dangerous propensity of the product, which would allow this court to affirm the District Court's finding that there should be no recovery allowed to plaintiffs for silly economic losses, and also that they should be not denied, were properly denied, leave to amend. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. My name is Mr. Reisis. Reisis?
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Mike Reisis, and I'm here today for Blocker. We were named in four counts, 12 through 15. Of those counts, however, one count remains pending in the District Court, count 14. Three were dismissed, 12, 13, and 15. Of those three counts, count 12 purportedly was based on a third-party beneficiary theory. The short answer is you've heard no argument today with respect to that count on a third-party beneficiary theory. No argument was made in the brief. We believe Central has waived its right to review the dismissal of that count. We ask you to affirm the dismissal of that count. Count 13 and count 15 were based purportedly on assignments. You have already heard from Mr. Talon with respect to the assignment theory, and we certainly join in those arguments. It is basically our position that Section 15 does not create any assignment in favor of Central. All it does is provide that Catellus is making no warranty, and that Central, as the tenant, will have to rely on warranties, if any, granted by the contractor, architect, etc. Well, that's all covered in count 14, which is in the trial court, District Court, where we have been named on a breach of warranty theory. The last count, this before Your Honor, honors today, is count 15. Again, that is based on an assignment. It's based on a different contract as between Blocker's contract with Catellus. Substantively, that contract requires that any assignment of those rights has to be with the written consent of Blocker. There is no allegation in count 15 that there was any written consent for that assignment. Accordingly, we ask that you affirm dismissal of count 15. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I believe each of you had a little time. Mr. Kelly?
The first attorney had exactly 3 minutes, the second attorney 2.5.
Okay.
More than some of my colleagues had on the other side. Yeah, hopefully I can get it done. Quickly, Your Honors, with respect to our position on the application of the economic loss doctrine, our position is that the economic loss doctrine does not bar our claim. Doesn't matter whether or not you view it as not applying or as an application, an exception. That's because we're not suing for economic loss. We're suing for damage to our property. Secondly, counsel for Mr. Nowacki, counsel for Catellus argued that the Chicago flood case said that there was a quick loss of perishable property. There's nothing in that case that discusses how quickly that perishable property was lost when the lights went out. We've all been through electrical outages, and if you keep the freezer closed, you're okay. 12 or 24 hours later, you got to start to eat ice cream quickly. But in any event, the damage to that perishable property is nothing in that case that says it happened quickly, instantaneously, or in any given length of time. With respect to the argument as to the way that molecule traveled, and Ms. Anderlich did it in a brief, and Mr. Nowacki did it here today, trying to trace the slow progress of that molecule. None of that matters. What matters is when it gets from one side of this polypropylene to the other. That's what matters with respect to the timing. With respect to the claim that there was that we with the amendment of the pleading, that we should have amended our pleading after. Mr. Nowacki argued, well, you know, they lost before the district court, and afterwards they filed an additional pleading and they didn't amend it. The court had already denied us leave to do so, Your Honor. And I think what Mrs. Nowacki is suggesting is that we should have ignored that ruling and gone ahead and filed the amendment anyway. That I think would have been an insult to the court and would have been inappropriate. Ms. Anderlich argues that there was no duty to provide a warning. That's an argument that they did not raise below. And for that reason and the other cited in our brief, that argument should be rejected. Finally, with respect to the argument on the temperature, Mr. Anderlich said, you know, they're just, what's going on in that warehouse, it was a problem. What if they'd raise the temperature? And we heard a lot about that. If AUL had raised the temperature, then our remedy would have been against AUL under the contract. But AUL didn't raise the temperature. What happened is they built the facility in such a manner as to contaminate our product. The argument that contract law would provide a better remedy in this situation than negligence is clearly belied by what is going on in the contract phase of the case. And finally, with respect to the argument the one final point, the Dixie-Portland case, that case clearly points out that some tort-like damages act more slowly. So the whole question of timing is one that is fact-based and should not have been ruled upon in a motion for summary motion to dismiss. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Lieber?
Briefly, Your Honors, what I would like to do is read to you on the issue of assignment language from the Ribbon versus Dye Molding case, which is applicable and has never been distinguished by anyone in their briefs in this case. The language at page 361 states, the creation and existence of an assignment is to be determined according to the intention of the parties, and that intention is a question of fact to be derived not only from the instruments executed by them, but from the surrounding circumstances as well. This was a motion to dismiss, not a motion for summary judgment before the district court. The district court made a ruling on what the Illinois law has repeatedly held to be a fact question. It is a fact question whether the language in Section 15 constitutes an assignment or not. It is premature for it to be dismissed by the district court. There is no question that the district court made an error in terms of the arbitration aspect, and it is also incorrect for there to be a ruling that the testimony of the parties to that agreement cannot be considered. The second point that I want to read to you on behalf of AUL with respect to the In Re Chicago flood case, We have taken the position that it is not a disappointed commercial expectation. The language on page 276 of the In Re Chicago Flood case with respect to lost perishable inventory states, in the present case, class plaintiffs do not seek damages for the loss of continuous electrical service, which is a disappointed commercial expectation. Rather, class plaintiffs seek damages for property loss in the form of lost perishable inventory as a result of a tortious event. Such damages are above and beyond class plaintiffs' disappointed commercial expectations in continuous electrical service. Thus, these losses fall outside the definition of economic loss and are recoverable in tort. That is exactly what we have said on behalf of AUL. AUL is not seeking to recover for the loss of its ability to occupy the space continuously, for lost revenues. We are suing in connection with the loss of goods that were bailed to us. One final point. Mr. Nowacki makes the point that AUL as a bailee is standing in the shoes of a bailor Nabisco. That is not the law. There is not a single case that has been cited by any party in this litigation that says the cause of action of a bailee is 100% a subrogation action from the bailor. AUL has an independent cause of action under Illinois law and the law in other jurisdictions, which holds that AUL has a possessory interest in the goods, and that is sufficient to maintain an action. For the foregoing reasons, the district court decision should be reversed. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. And thanks to all attorneys for staying within your time limits. You did a good job. That case will be taken under advisement. To the third case of the morning, the Franzoni versus Hartmarks. Give everybody a chance to get settled here. Mr. Sophie?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Ray Sophie. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this matter, Luciano Franzoni. Mr. Franzoni is present in court, and he's sitting over there on the left side of the courtroom. Your Honor, Mr. Franzoni was a longtime employee of Hartmarks Corporation. He started working there in 1968 and was fired in 1998, almost 30 years later. Hartmarks is a manufacturer and distributor of men's clothing throughout the world. They sell such brands as Austin Reed, Nino Cerruti, Pierre Cardin, Sanzibel, and of course at one time Reserva Luciani Franzoni. Your Honor, for approximately 29 years, Mr. Franzoni worked for the company. He was never reprimanded or given any warning that his job would be lost, and there's nothing in the record that shows he did anything adverse to the company's interests during that entire time. In 1997, Mr. Franzoni had a meeting with Mr. Patel, who was the president of the company. From Mr. Franzoni's perspective, he was having this meeting to try to get an increase in his compensation on the line of clothing that was being marketed by Hartmarks. Obviously, from reading the briefs, you know the conversation did not turn out the way Mr. Franzoni expected. Basically, Mr. Patel had certain documents in his hand from the personnel division of Hartmarks, which indicated that Mr. Franzoni was in his 29th year with the company. And the testimony in the record was that Mr. Patel told him he must retire on his 30th anniversary, which was some months later. The district court found that these conversations between the two were not stray remarks, and were made by the decision maker, Mr. Patel, who Mr. Franzoni believed ordered him to retire. Also, The district court found that prior to this meeting with Mr. Patel, there was no prior warning that Mr. Franzoni's job was in jeopardy. Your Honor, the district court held that on Mr. Franzoni's direct discrimination claim as the result of this meeting and the elimination of that job, that there was sufficient evidence to proceed to trial on that basis. We're here today because we contend the district court erred by invoking the McDonnell-Douglas analysis on an indirect method of a discrimination claim, when we contend that the Price-Waterhouse analysis applies. Because the district court found that there was direct evidence of discrimination, the district court should have placed the burden on Hartmarks to show that Mr. Franzoni would have been fired anyway absent age animus.
Well, in that line, if he, I guess there was, I don't know what reference at that meeting with Patel that was made as far as